this morning we talked a little bit about the ability to start observing the mind and becoming familiar with the mind, recognizing its essential empty nature, and then really questioning the whole function of our thinking. What is a thought? Where does it come from? Where does it go to? What does it look like? Who is thinking? Because if we recognize, I mean, the whole point, as I said before, and I say it again, is to recognize that that being that we cling to and that we identify is not our true nature. It's useful, and it's not when Buddhism says there is no self, it doesn't mean we don't exist. Obviously we exist. But we don't fundamentally, inherently exist in the way that we ignorantly conceive ourselves to do so. And so the bad news is that all the things which we associate with ourselves is not who we really are. But the good news is that who we really are is something so much more fantastic that if only we knew about it, we'd want it. So it's the way to get back to our very subtle consciousness. There are basically three consciousnesses being dealt with here. One is the gross consciousness. That's our ordinary mind, thinking mind. Brr, the ordinary stream of consciousness, mental consciousness. Then there is the subtle consciousness, which is the mindfulness, the ability to observe, which is very important. But that consciousness, that ability to witness or observe, is still a relative consciousness, because there's still a subject and object, an observer and an observed. Here, the observer is this subtle consciousness, the mindfulness, and the observed is the stream of thoughts and feelings which go through the mind. So this is already a big step, that we no longer are completely immersed in our thinking mind. We are able to stand back and observe the thinking mind. But it still is, as I say, a dualistic consciousness, because there is still a sense of I'm observing something. And behind that is the very subtle mind, which is our primordial awareness of the nature of luminous clarity and vast empty transparency. This is often compared to, as I said, to the sky, because the sky is infinite. It doesn't have any borders, it doesn't have any center, and it's omnipresent. It's not just up there, it's here. Everything is space. If I asked you what is in this temple, you would say, well, there are cushions, and there's a shrine, and there's a table, and there are pillars, and there are people. But really what there is space. If there was no space, there could be no objects. And the very objects themselves, of course, are space. One of the good things which modern knowledge of quantum physics, etc., has shown us is the fact that it has shown that however much we take a solid, seeming solid object and reduce it and reduce it and reduce it, at the end, you never can find the thing in itself. When I was in my first physics class, when I was 11, I asked our physics teacher, when we reduce everything down and down, what do we get? I thought, finally, I will get the answer to it. You know, when you get it really down to, what's the ultimate? And she went on about protons and neutrons. And at that moment, I lost interest in physics. And this is why I became a nun instead of a physicist. But if she had really understood what my question was, she would no doubt have brought up quantum physics. And the fact that, you know, because obviously if you have neutrons and protons, then you must be able to reduce neutrons and protons. Right? I mean, it's obvious. Even at 11, I understood that much. So when you go down and down and down, what do you get? Well, basically what you get is space and energy, which is exactly what the Buddhists have been describing the mind as for the last 2,600 years. But space, yes, because ungraspable. You can't catch it, you can't hold it, you can't say, this is me. But not just space, because space, sky, is not aware. And this, the mind, is the very nature of knowing. It's the very nature of cognizance, of awareness. So it is completely aware, but at the same time very open. It's not a sense in that state of open awareness. It's not a sense of me and others. There are no inward boundaries. The mind is infinite, open, but very simple. Very simple, but just very clear, very aware, absolutely present. And luminous. Luminous in the sense of very bright, vivid. Which is our nature. So to get back to that, to our essential nature, behind this observer, who is already very important, we need to become conscious of being conscious. We need to be aware of the awareness. Normally when we are aware, we are not aware that we're aware, because we are so caught up in all our thinking. Now we are resting in that basic level of awareness. So that means it's very similar to Soto Zen, where they just sit and are, as I say, conscious of being conscious without making any effort. It's very effortless. You just, after all, we are all aware the whole time. If you were not aware, you wouldn't hear me, you wouldn't see me, you wouldn't be able to think. Just because we have eyes and ears, if we don't have consciousness, it wouldn't help. So we all have it, but we're not usually aware of that, because we're so busy thinking or looking or doing something. Now we're not doing anything. We're just resting in that quality of awakeness. Because if we do that, then of itself, naturally, it will begin to dissolve that sense of the duality of the mind, of subject and object. And gradually one can begin to get glimpses of something even more profound, more subtle, which is the very essence of that quality, which is called the primordial awareness, or Rigpa. Okay, so go back a bit. I'd like to talk a little bit about the ego. The ego gets very bad press in Buddhist texts. The sense of I. And yet, almost all of the path is predicated on the idea of an ego which needs to be tamed and trained and then dissolved. I mean, the nature of the mind, our Buddha nature, doesn't need anything, right? It doesn't have to aspire, it doesn't have to hope or have courage or determination. It's the nature of the mind. It's our Buddha nature, our Tathagatagarbha. That's fine. What is not fine is our false sense of identity. But in order to dissolve our false sense of identity, we have to walk the path. Who is walking the path? The false sense of identity. Do you see? 98% of the path is dealing with how we are while we are still deluded. What we are deluded with is our sense of ego. So it's the ego that has to walk the path, even though it's going to its own annihilation, which is why we resist it. No, truthfully. In the Pali tradition, we do not completely drop our sense of self until we become an arhat. That means until we enter nirvana. And in the Mahayana tradition, not until one is an eighth level bodhisattva. That's an awfully long way down the road. In the meantime, despite glimpses of reality, we then fall back again into our delusion. A little bit clearer, but still, it's there. Because, you know, even if one has a glimpse of the nature of the mind, the ego immediately grabs it. And then the ego thinks, now I'm something special, now I'm enlightened. Right? And so we're back again. I mean, I think this is a very important point, and I think that the Chittamatra system got it much more clearly than anybody. In the Chittamatra system, very simple, simply put, the first five, there are eight consciousnesses, eight level of consciousness. And in the first five are the sense consciousnesses, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, and so forth. The sixth consciousness is the mental consciousness, which makes sense of everything which is being received through the senses, so to speak. This is basic Buddhism, all schools. But what was interesting in Chittamatra, who were especially, they're also called the Yogacara, they are the people who really were interested in the mind. They weren't very interested in outer objects. They were very, very interested in the mind and how it works. And they posited an eighth consciousness. We leave the seventh for a minute. We got the five sense consciousness, the sixth, the mental consciousness. Then there's the eighth consciousness. Now, the eighth consciousness is called the Alaya Vijñana. The word Alaya means a store, a storehouse, as in Himalaya. Himalaya means a storehouse of snow. So the Alaya consciousness is the consciousness which stores. Because if we only have momentary consciousness, then where are all our memories? Where is all our karmic seeds through countless lifetimes? Where is all that? So they posited the idea that rather like the floor of the ocean, right? You've got the surface consciousness, and then you go down through, you know, the deep, you know, all the beautiful things in the, under the ocean, and all the, you know, the monsters of the deep, all of it is all there. It's very like the unconscious. And then you get the floor of the ocean in which all our memories and all our karmic actions of body, speech, and mind, all our intentional actions of body, speech, and mind, they all go down to the floor of this ocean of the mind. And that's where, when causes and conditions come, then one will flourish. And that's how we keep going, moment to moment to moment, receiving the results of past karma. And how we respond is creating future karma. Okay, now, so you've got these six consciousnesses, and you've got this huge Alaya consciousness, which the Tibetans, by the way, do not translate as Alaya. They translated it as Kunji. Kunji means literally an all basis or a substratum consciousness, right? They had the idea it's a foundation of everything. Kun is all, and ji means a foundation or a basis. And the Kunji also has two aspects. So one is matakpa, impure. So there's the impure alaya, the impure kunji, which is the one in which all these seeds and memories and everything is stored. That is still very samsaric. If one goes into very deep meditation, one can hit the bottom. But it's and get a very universal kind of experience, and people think, ah, I'm enlightened. But actually, it's just that one has hit the kunji. But the other aspect of kunji, like a coin on two sides, the other aspect is the dakpa kunji. The dakpa is the pure alaya vijnana, which is synonymous with the Tathagata Nyingpo, the Tathagarbha, the Buddha nature, Deji Nyingpo. The pure alaya is synonymous with the nature of the mind. So there are two alayas. But you've got the alaya, and you've got the six consciousnesses, six consciousness alaya. And then, if they go like that, imagine, then this little bit is the seventh consciousness. They overlap. And the seventh consciousness is the one that's interesting here in this particular point. It's called the Klesha Mano Vijnana. Klesha means afflicted. Mano means mind and or mental content, and the Vijnana means consciousness. So it's an afflicted mental consciousness. It's afflicted. Why? Because according to the Chittamatra school, it is the source of the thought I, which is a combination of the six mental consciousnesses coming into contact with the alaya vijnana. It gives rise to a sense of feeling I am. Now, it's a klesha mano because it's afflicted, because it's deluded, because there is no I in the way that it thinks it is. On the other hand, it is karmically neutral because the sense of self can be used if it's filled with greed and aggression and jealousy and pride and so forth, then that's very negative. But if it's filled with love, compassion, aspiration, desire for the path, desire to help other beings, then it's positive. So it goes either way. Therefore, in itself, this sense of I is karmically neutral. Depends what you do with it. And what we need to do with it is walking on the path. Now, in order to... there's no way you're going to pretend that you're walking on the path egolessly. Well, you might pretend. So the fact is that most of us, when we're walking on the path, we definitely have a sense of me and others. So the point then is to have a sense of self which is healthy. And in this, meditation also helps us to heal. If we have a limb, like an arm, which is injured, you know, we broke our arm or it has a nasty festering sore on it, then we protect that arm. We can't use it very effectively because it's injured. But we protect it, and because it hurts, we're always thinking about it. And if somebody hits us, it's painful because it's injured. But if our arm is healthy, then not only can we make use of it, it's very helpful to have a hand, but also we're not really thinking about it. How many of you think about your arm every day? Plus, if somebody hits it just ordinarily, well, it's nothing. Somebody bumps against it, you don't even think about it. So this is like the sense of ego. If our ego is in pain, if our ego is injured and sick, then we are always thinking about it. We're protecting it. If somebody says anything to us, we get very defensive and upset, and we overreact. And we don't function well in the world because we're injured. So before we can dissolve the ego, we have to have a healthy, well-balanced ego to dissolve. Really. And so beating ourselves over the head and endlessly thinking only about our faults and never thinking about our good qualities and endlessly bringing ourselves down is not humility. That's just being mean to ourselves in a way that we would not be mean to others. If we spoke to others the way we speak to ourselves, we wouldn't have any friends. And since we cannot get away from ourselves, it's very important that we make friends with ourselves. This is why the Buddha recommended doing loving kindness and compassion meditation first to ourselves. We have to befriend ourselves, encourage ourselves, believe in ourselves. Okay, so we've got faults. Who doesn't have faults? If we didn't have faults, we'd be a Buddha. We wouldn't need a path. We need the Dharma. Because of course we have faults, everybody does. But that faults which we have, that is the path. Learning how to develop and overcome our shortcomings, that's the path. But at the same time, we also notice our natural good qualities and encourage those along too. It's like in a garden. Yeah, you look in the garden and you can see all the weeds which need to be pulled out. But if you don't look at the flowers, what's the use having a garden that you only see the weeds? We have flowers in our gardens and we water those flowers. We encourage the flowers to grow. And tell the garden how lovely it is. So the garden will feel happy and grow better and better. So this question of the ego really has to be seen carefully, because just putting ourselves down constantly doesn't do it. We just end up depressed and feeling hopeless. And that's not what it's meant. You know, if you read even in the Bodhicaryavatara, I mean, again and again he uses this warrior imagery, because he was, Shantideva was apparently a prince before, and so he uses, as the Buddha did, warrior imagery. But the idea of a hero, a spiritual hero, not a wimp, never is that encouraged. Even if we're learning how to be more patient, how to be tolerant, how to be compassionate, how to deal with enemies by being forbearing, it's not from a basis of self-loathing or a basis of cowardice and weakness. It's from our inner strength and courage that no matter what happens, we will inwardly triumph. So it's very important, this point. And this is brought up in the tantras. The tantras, of course, I do have lamas who've written books on it, were based on the Chittamatra view. In fact, you have, you know, in the mandala, the figures of eight bodhisattvas and a lot of the imagery is based on the Chittamatra psychological framework. Even the idea of a Buddha nature. And the tantras, of course, I mean, they are very complex imagery and so forth. But the basic idea, the basic underlying idea is that normally we see ourselves as ordinary, flawed, sentient beings. And we are trying to get to Buddhahood. And so there's the path. And slowly we get there until we're, you know, at the top of the mountain. But the tantras said, inherently we all possess Buddha nature. So rather than thinking of ourselves as flawed sentient beings walking up slowly on the path, how about if we took the result, Buddhahood, and brought it right at the start and used that conviction as our path? So we start with the acknowledgement that we already are Buddhas. That actually the idea that we're traveling on a path is only very relative. Ultimately, we're already there. And in order to do this, one sees oneself with what is called the pride of the deity. That means that when one does the practice, the most important thing if one is doing Yidam practice, I assume some of you are doing Yidam practice. The most important thing, absolutely, is not the clarity of visualization, but the conviction that whether we see it or not, it's there. So if we are seeing the deity outside of ourselves or on top of our head, then the conviction that even we can't see them, they're there. But most importantly, if we are seeing ourselves as the deity, the absolute belief that the knowledge that we are the deity, we really are. When for many people, the problem is that we don't believe it. So, for example, if Aileen was doing a Tara practice. Sunma Aileen here, she's doing a Tara practice, and she's sitting there doing her Tara, seeing herself as Tara. This is Tara. But at the back of the mind is a thought, now, of course, I'm Aileen, and now I'm going to transform myself and pretend to be Tara. And we think that's what's true. You know, I'm ailing, but I'm going to pretend to be Tara good. But of course, the truth is that she is Tara pretending to be ailing. Do you understand? Tara isn't out there somewhere. It's our true nature. It's a reflection of our Buddha nature. That's who we are. It's our delusion that we think we're just who, you know, some mere sentient being. And so this pride of the deity, as it's called, is very important. It's this conviction of really understanding, yes, of course I'm Tara. Who else? Now I have to pretend to be whoever, you know, and I'm like any actor, I'm going to play my role to the best of my abilities. But it's only a role. Next life, a different role. If we met ourselves in our past life, we wouldn't recognize ourselves. We've probably changed our gender for a start. And our race. Many things. If we met ourselves, who's that? We're in a different role. Next lifetime, who knows? But the one thing which stays constant is our Buddha nature. That never changes. And so in the tantras, the main idea behind all the elaborations which it goes through is this conviction that of acquiring what is called pure perception or pure view, pure vision, which is the understanding that essentially we are the deity, that all sound, including a speech, is the mantra of the deity, and that our external environment is the pure land of the deity. And of course, it doesn't mean, for example, that I say and think, oh yes, I am Tara. Those are mere sentient beings. I'm Tara. All beings are Tara. Sometimes they say all the males are Chenrezig, all the females are Jetsundroma, Atara. But it's the pure perception comes from looking at everyone and recognizing their Buddha potential, that they really are divine. Just don't know it. Don't see it. I'm not in contact with that. Just a while back, when I was in, a few years ago, I visited this very extraordinary nunnery in eastern Tibet called Gebcha, where all the 300 nuns, they all live in little boxes about this big, and they never lie down. They sleep sitting up, and they practice sitting up, and they're always, they never lie. And they're also great experts in inner heat meditation in Tummo. Last year, in the dead of winter in Tibet, the 68 nuns walked around the outside of the temple drying wet sheets in the middle of the night. And someone who was there said, all these clouds of steam rising up. And they're not wearing anything. They're just wearing a little tiny kind of like a mini skirt. And that's all they wear at that time. And these wet sheets, and they dry them. I'm not sure if the one who dries the most sheets gets the prize, but... and when they die in meditation called Tukdam, which means that although they are... classically dead, that the heart is still warm, they don't go into rigor mortis, and the body stays very pliant, and often after a few days then they give off a very beautiful perfume. And last year two nuns died. They both stayed in Tukdam. One of them was 26. She died of TB, And she stayed in Thukdam for a week. And then when she was cremated, then they found all these syllables on her spine. So anyway, they're extraordinary nuns. But when I went to visit them some years ago, we went to see one of the old nuns, and she was living in this kind of black hut with no windows, a little tiny window, and it was very dark and very black inside because they keep the fire, you know, to make the tea. And she was sitting in her little box. And the younger nun who was taking care of her, she said that a few days before, she had been sweeping, the assistant nun had been sweeping the floor. And the other nun said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Well, I'm sweeping the floor, it's dirty." Dirty? This is the pure land of Chenrezig. It's absolutely beautiful. So the nun, So I think that, you know, really they do get a very deep level of pure perception. And of course, when she died, actually, she was, she was explaining the prayer to go to the pure land of Amitabha. And then suddenly she opened her eyes wide, laughed, and went. And of course, she stayed in Thukdam forever. I mean, she was one of their senior nuns, and she just went on for, you know, about 2 weeks or more. But the fact is, anyway, the important fact is that during the day, we are trying to be practical here. During the day, apart from observing the mind, which is really very important, one also should try, if you are doing Yidam practice, to maintain this sense of the pride of the deity during the day and the recognition that all the beings who come into our orbit are part of the mandala. Really, otherwise it ain't going to work. We have to transform the mind. Of course, if you are dealing with a deity who has multiple arms, and therefore you can't decide which one you're going to use to pick up your cup of tea. Actually, the advice is if you're dealing with a multi-armed deity, to dissolve all those arms into two. And if they've got many heads, to dissolve them into one. I mean, you have to, you know, be practical. But the main thing is not actually, you know, to visualize all your jewels or all your writhing snakes or whatever. But this sense, you know, whenever I'm in a very nervous situation, challenging, like having to offer a mandala to the Karmapa or something, I say to myself, I just remind myself that one is the deity. You know, if you think of that, then suddenly I feel my whole body aligns when I think of that. If one is the Yidam, then what's the problem? No problem. One time I was taking a Vajrayogini Wong from our oldest yogi, and there were two other Western nuns. And we were Dharma sisters together, and whenever anybody needed an empowerment, then the lamas would wait till all three of us got together and give it to us all together. And so we were getting a Vajrayogini Wong, and then this the Dutch nun, she said to the yogi, I mean, he was explaining about divine pride, and she said, the Vajrayogini in Tibetan is Pamo. So she said, "Nga Pamo Yin?" And he got this heavy book, Tibetan, and he bashed her on the head, crash. Ah, Pomoines! You don't just say, really, I'm Pomo? I am Pomo. That's very important. That total conviction. Not, well, maybe, maybe not. Nga Pomo Yins. And so this is a way of really cutting through a lot of our false identification. Because while we recognize that we cannot go around, you know, actually telling people, well, between you and me, really, I'm Tara. You might have noticed. Nonetheless, inside ourselves should be the conviction that we are who we, you know, we are something beyond who we think we are, and that all the play of our thoughts really is the play of wisdom, and that all sounds that we hear really are the sound of the mantra. And as much as we can remember that, all beings we meet really are divine forms. We don't recognize it. We think good, bad, nice, nasty. But really they're all yidams of the mandala. You know, this is very important. If one is practicing the tantric path, one has to transform one's life into one's practice. And during the day, another very helpful thing can be that during the day, whenever one can, to just try to keep the mantra going. Maybe if it's a very complicated mantra, then make it a simple mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum or Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Svaha. But keep it going. When I was in England before I came to India, so this is in the early 60s. I heard about the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum. So I asked a lama who was there if it would be okay to say Om Mani Padme Hum, and of course he said yes. Can you imagine him saying no? But I didn't have any idea about visualization, or even, I don't know if I knew who, I guess I knew who Chen Resik was, but I didn't know much. But I thought that you had to keep saying it, that much I did think, that you had to always repeat it. But because I was working in a library, and these were the early 60s and not the late 60s, there were no hippies yet, to go around muttering mantras would have been considered decisively weird. So rather than going around muttering Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, I was saying Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum in my mind. And so I obviously was making great efforts to keep it going despite what I was doing. I mean, I was working in the library, I was dealing with people and you know, and so forth. But in the back of my mind, I was keeping this Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 the whole time. And what happened was that after two or three days of incessantly saying Om Mani Padme Hum consciously in my head, suddenly the mantra dropped down to here. And it started reverberating all by itself. I didn't have to do anything. It was just reverberating. The whole inner part, it was just reverberating on Mani Padme Hum, Mani Padme Hum. And at the same time, the ordinary thought stream just naturally separated. So there was the awareness, the Om Mani Padme Hum, Mani Padme Hum in space, and then all the thoughts and feelings. And so one could see the thoughts and feelings and recognize those which were beneficial, and those which were pretty useless, and just drop those which... But basically, thought patterns became very beneficial because they were going through the barrier of Lon Mani Padme Hum. And it, a great sense of awareness and being absolutely centered and at the same time surrounded outwardly and inwardly by the reverberations of the mantra. So these mantras are very powerful, even if you don't know what you're doing. They have their own power. Because in the case of Om Mani Padme Hum, I mean, it was bestowed on us by Chen Rezig, and is the essence of Chen Rezig. So therefore, of course, it's powerful. And also, through the millenniums, so many beings have recited this mantra. So naturally, it's powerful. But apart from Om Mani Padme Hum, I mean, there are many mantras or prayers, a short prayer. In the Russian Orthodox, of course, there's the Jesus Prayer. You know, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner. Which, when they repeated it again and again, had exactly the same results. It's if you have something, some kind of saying or mantra which has power, then saying it as much as one can, it does not interfere with one's daily life. This is what I would like you to understand. Far from interfering with our daily life, it brings us back into mindfulness. It brings us back into the present moment. It brings us back to focus on what we're actually doing, what we're actually saying, what we're actually thinking. And it doesn't take time. So this is another skillful thing to think about. Especially if one's mind tends to be distracted and, you know, we don't have, our mindfulness is weak, then to make the commitment to recite a short mantra, I mean, something like Vajrasattva would be too heavy for the mind. It needs to be a short mantra, and to keep that repeated. Really, it's quite miraculous. Once the mind gets into, you know, the flow of it, how it brings the attention back into the present, and far from being a distraction, it becomes a conduit into awareness. So if one is a practitioner of Tantra, then it's very important to keep that sense of divine pride, and if possible to keep the mantra or a mantra going in the mind, and recognize that all thoughts are the play of the wisdom mind. Why? Because they're empty. We solidify them and we classify them, but in the end, they're all just empty bubbles. And they arise from the wisdom mind, like clouds arising in the sky. If we look in the sky, sometimes it's covered in clouds, white clouds, black clouds, rainbows, but they all come from the sky. They go back into the sky again. They arise because of causes and conditions, but in themselves they have no solidity, constantly changing. That's our mind, our thoughts, our feelings. And it really can be very helpful to decide where our minds will dwell, because whether we are living in a heaven or a hell realm, whether we are living in a pure realm or if we're living in a state of, you know, really like a hell realm, in the end, it all depends on us. We have to really learn how to deal skillfully with this mind we have been given, which is a wonderful mind which has incredible potential. But if we don't use it properly, it can drag us down. If we learn how to deal with it and how to go backwards and backwards into the very subtle nature of our mind, then here and now there is Buddhahood. But in fact, the path takes a lot of patience, a lot of perseverance. Or no, almost nobody just goes zoom, 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 zoom like this. You know, you go up a little bit, then you go down, and then you have a stagnant piece, and then you go up a little bit, and then you go down. And I mean, you know, I mean, in all truth, very, very few beings just go keep on a steady trajectory, up and up. And then there you are, the Buddha's standing at the top. You've got the prize, here you are, well done. Son and daughter of good family. The path requires patience. The path requires persistence. It requires a lot of faith. It really does require faith. Faith is not something very popular nowadays in the modern world. But we need to believe that this path is true, is genuine, that we really do have Buddha nature, and that can really be realized for the sake not just of ourselves but for all beings. How are we going to help really if we ourselves are still so immersed in ignorance? We can do what we can to help on a relative level, but ultimately we have to pull ourselves out of the swamp in order to pull others out of that swamp. And it takes time. Somebody asked his own the Dalai Lama, what is the quickest, easiest way to enlightenment? I'm sure it was an American. Okay, what's the quickest, easiest way to enlightenment? Anyway, apparently His Holiness looked at the questioner. Then put his head down and just burst into tears. And he said every morning he makes the aspiration that for as long as space endures, for as long as sentient beings exist, for that long I pray to come back for the sake of all beings. That's the point. It's a long haul. It's not a quick cop-out. But the good news is that if we could just get our minds to understand even something of the nature of how things really are, we could really make our passage through samsara so much easier, both for ourselves and for others. It's our clinging mind which is the problem. We cling to others, we cling to ourselves, we cling to everything. Samsara is often depicted as a wheel, but you know, we are not chained on that wheel. We are holding on to it tightly. We can't let go. So if you really want a short mantra, my mantra would be, let go. That solves so much. Let go at all levels. Enjoy your tea back at 3:30.